Red Sox are in Florida.
Major funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This week we look back and ahead at just how the attacks of September 11th have altered this world. We'll talk about Americans' evolving understanding of themselves and others, about the effects of a year fighting a different kind of war, about changes in the way that America is seen abroad. On Wednesday, September 11th, we will report on events in New York, Washington, Pennsylvania, and Boston. But we start this week by examining what came to be, in the hours after the attack, a point of seemingly incontrovertible and unanimous agreement. After the incomprehension, the scale and measure of loss, the notion that after today, things will never be the same, emerged as a kind of national mantra. Those very words were spoken by a bicycle courier in Washington, D.C. to the writer P.J. O'Rourke. The idea is central to conversations I've had with the journalist and academic Geneva Overholser, and they continue to inform the columns of Newsweek's Fuad Ajami. Connection listeners, it's a simple question today. Has the country changed? Have you? Last autumn, people said that seriousness had replaced whimsy, introspection had replaced irony, and patriotism had replaced pridefulness. Well, where are they now? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. As I mentioned, my guest today from New York, from Washington, D.C., and from Peterborough, New Hampshire, Fuad Ajami, Geneva Overholser, and P.J. O'Rourke. All of you, welcome to the program. P.J., let me start with you, the bicycle courier that you met on the morning of the attacks in Washington, D.C. You reported his remarks at the time. Were they, what was he saying? After today, nothing will ever be the same. Was that what you were thinking as well?
And the bicycle courier that I talked to was a person who was obviously crazy and had been for a long time before 9/11. In fact, I was, irony may be out of fashion, but I was using some when I reported his remarks. I thought it was an incredibly stupid thing to say. The world has been the world forever. The world, nothing... The world did not change on 9/11. Maybe we got a little smarter about it. I mean, it was an awful thing that happened, and I think we became a little more alert to the awfulness of the world, but the world didn't change. The world has been the world and will continue to be.
You know, I heard a lot of people saying the same thing, though. What you're saying sounds a little hard.
Well, I suppose, you know, it is. One doesn't know what to say when something like this happens, and one way to put it is that things will never be the same, by which people mean I will never see the world in quite the same way. They don't really mean that things have changed. They mean their perception of things have changed. Now, I'm being unfair to people. When one is confronted with a horrible catastrophe, it is impossible not to fall into cliché. The mind simply does not have the words that are adequate to respond, and so we respond with, you know, we sort of pick the first words that pop into mind and say that. The meaning behind it is what's really crucial. The words. Now, I think a lot of columnists today and sort of think tank, or not think tank, but sort of pundit types, have taken the words that we spoke in shock and ascribed a much more prosaic and much less interesting meaning to those words than the depth of emotion from which those words came would deserve.
Geneva, let's hear from you. Things will never be the same.
P.J. O'Rourke drew between whether the world has changed or whether our view of the world has changed. But I wouldn't be so inclined to minimize the latter. I mean, I agree that the world is essentially the same, but the fact that we view it differently is more than a cliché. It's very real, isn't it? And it's very powerful. I mean, I think our memories have changed and our fears have changed. We as a nation, we as Americans, not just individually, but we're right to presume that that's true for our loved ones. It's not, clearly in the days and weeks and months and now a full year that followed 9/11, we've returned to a life that's much more like the one we lived. You know, we get, as the Times says this morning, we've had more people patted down and more people locked up, but fundamentally we've returned to something like our previous lives. But we are all changed emotionally.
Our memories have changed, though, Geneva?
Sure, because what we have to remember that day a year ago is unlike anything most of us had experienced. The power of that day, I think, in defining us as a nation will be much longer lasting than your version of the events would seem to me to indicate. I fundamentally agree with you that the people's views of us, we've simply become more aware of them, probably, although our behavior as a nation has changed enough to affect people's views of us, too. But I guess I think that simply to say, well, it's only how we view the world that has changed is not to say a small thing. How we view the world has changed, how we feel as people and as a nation has changed. It's pretty fundamental, mm-hmm. It seems to me.
Fuad Ajami, you write about it as September 11th as a great divide in the American calendar.
Absolutely, Dick. I think first let me just make a small correction. I write these columns for U.S. News and World Report so I can keep my job.
I'm sorry about that.
But I'm my own feeling about September 11, of course, is colored by the fact that I'm an immigrant child of this country. I came here at 18. In the early 1960s. And of course, we know that September 11 was an assault from the old lands that I came from the old lands of the Arab world, into America. So on the morning of September 11, 2001, 19 young Arabs, these were young Arabs, we should understand where they came from, we should know what this is about, assaulted the very integrity of this country on a clear September morning. And I think our sense of invulnerability, our sense of isolation, our sense of distance from the outside world has been irrevocably changed. So I share some of what my colleagues said, though I do put on it this emphasis that the distance from the old world and the furies of the old world and the fires of the old world no longer exist. My generation of Arabs and Muslims who came to this country came eager to forget the fires of the old world. There is obviously a very different assault and a very different migration and a very different reality has dawned on America in the aftermath of these attacks.
The fires of the old world that you're describing, yes. Fuad, they didn't go anywhere. Is it just that technology and ingenuity and,
yes.
and globalized, call it whatever you want, brought them back, brought them closer?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, these were, I describe these young Arabs, Muhammad Atta, the chilling psychopath who led the lead hijacker, this young Egyptian. I describe them as nowhere men. That is, they were born, they were formed on the seam, on the fault line between the West and the Muslim world. These are young men who could no longer live in their own lands. They were on the road. They were drifters. They were drifters in Hamburg. They were drifters in Canada. They were drifters in Spain and so on. And they came our way. And one interesting thing to me about the ease with which this kind of liberal open country like ours could be penetrated is summed up as follows. We do know that Muhammad Atta, the lead hijacker, and a younger associate of his started their flight to Logan Airport by boarding a smaller flight in Portland, Maine. And what they did in Portland, Maine tells us a story. What they did is they took money from the ATM machine. They ate at Pizza Hut. They went to the Walmart where they spent 20 minutes, where we suspect they bought the box cutters, and they slept at the Comfort Inn. These are all pieces of the American culture easily available to this young generation of drifters. So the very openness of our country was our source of vulnerability. We live with this. This is the pain of the American experience today and the incomprehension of these kinds of furies and hatreds for us in these distant lands.
PJ, let me hear from you. These, the Pizza Hut, the Walmart, the ATM, these are the features of America that always pop up in your writing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I'm as American as they come. And You know, I do. It is a sad irony that the very openness and freedom. But Fuad Ajami, who I may say is my, I use him always as my Virgil in the Arab world. He is, I think, one of the clearest thinkers and clearest writers about this. It brings me to a point that's been on my mind for a bit, is that America is often accused of being xenophobic, of hating foreigners. And, you know, there's a bit of, more than a bit of truth in that. And the source of the truth is exactly what Fuad Ajami said. We hate foreigners because we are foreigners. I mean, except for a few of us who happen to be here, came across the Bering land bridge. We are foreigners. We came here, like my family did in the 1840s, to get away from the things that were going from the furies of the old world. We hate foreigners because we understand what we're running from and what we're trying to get away from. And it's come after us a number of times in our history. One arguably could say beginning in 1776, certainly War of 1812, most certainly World War I and World War II. We can never fully escape the furies of the old world, and yet we do a marvelous job in our way. There's no such thing as fighting between Protestant and Catholic Irish in the United States. I come from Toledo, Ohio, near Dearborn, Michigan, largest community of Arabs in the world outside of the Middle East. There's no fighting between Sunnis and Shiites, between Christians and Muslim Arabs, or indeed between Arabs and Jews in Dearborn, in Detroit, in Toledo.
Are you saying? That's a fake construct?
I say it's a marvelous thing. It's a wonderful thing. And I think it is the very thing that the furies from the old world, these nowhere men, that was what they were trying to destroy. We have built a country in which everybody, in a slightly crabby way, does get along.
You know, that's funny. I would argue that the most powerful thing right now about our views of foreigners is not that we hate them, but that we're so ignorant of the rest of the world. Not just right now, it was true before 9/11. But it seems to me that the way we respond after 9/11 to the rest of the world is so critical, and I don't feel as hopeful as I wanted to feel in the immediate wake of this horrible tragedy, that we were going to learn from it and open our minds to understanding better, and frankly, this is critical, have a media that would help us understand better, so that our response, those of us who are journalists, would be really to improve the foreign news we bring.
I think we understand perfectly. I mean, I understand the IRA absolutely perfectly in every detail, and I hate their guts. It isn't that Americans don't understand what's going on in the rest of the world. We have deliberately turned our backs on it. We want it to go away. Now, that might be wishful thinking.
That might be what you want, PJ, but the American public doesn't want it to go away. It's interesting to see how the views among the American public differ so strongly from the views among our current foreign policy makers. I mean, even in the most recent polls, for example, which I'm sure you've seen, comparing European views and American views among the public is interested in strengthening the United Nations. The public takes all sorts of stances which are toward connectedness, but we have very poor understanding of what the rest of the world thinks of us.
Connection listeners, you are the people who we need to hear from in this hour. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Your sense of what changed, if anything changed, after September 11, 2001. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. This hour we're talking about what, if anything, has changed since September 11, 2001. With me on the program, PJ O'Rourke, Geneva Overholser, and Fuad Ajami. Veteran journalists, writers, all, and we have been talking about how the United States is seen from abroad, how Americans see the way that view looks in across the borders, and I guess I'm listening to the conversation at this point and thinking that maybe we're missing at least one group of people. There was the French newspaper headline in the days after September 11th that said, mm-hmm. Nous sommes tous Américains, we are all Americans. The same thing was said in a Canadian newspaper that I held a couple of days after September 11th. And you know, at the time, I wasn't sitting here. I was up north and anxious to get down here and in part as a journalist, but in part just as a North American to try and get a little bit closer to what appeared to be a tremendous amount of suffering that had been visited on such a large group of people in this country, and that was all new. So when we talk about the view from abroad, we need to be a little bit more precise, Fouad.
That's very interesting that you mentioned that Le Monde banner headline, Nous sommes tous Américains, because the person who wrote it was Jean-Marie Colombani, and a few months later, he wrote another headline called Tous Américains with a question mark. Are we all Americans? And in fact, the sympathy was not destined to last, because in large parts of the world, we must be candid about this, there was a feeling that America had gotten its comeuppance. This was true in the Muslim world in particular. This is true in lands which are most intimately connected with us. For example, this is true in Saudi Arabia and Egypt, among large percentages of the population. And there were all kinds of arguments in many, many societies that were in some way subliminal. They, after the initial sympathy for America, all these hidden sources of anti-Americanism came to the surface. So I think the world was horrified. The world was shocked. But the world had seen, we were as a country, America in the 1990s, seemed almost resistance to the laws of gravity. We were on a roll economically. We had these interventions in Kuwait, and then after that in Bosnia and Kosovo. We were successful. And I think in some measure, on September 11, 2001, the response of the world to our calamity was very, very ambiguous.
But it seems to me that there was a great deal of emotional responsiveness, Fouad, that was in the spirit of this Nous sommes tous Américains, that came into an environment, after all, where there had been some unsettlement about American policies. I mean, we had not supported the Kyoto Agreement. There was a lot of unsettlement about that. We had clearly been exhibiting this go-it-alone tendency, and then all of a sudden this terrible thing befell America, and there was a great deal of responsiveness, emotional support, as well as the ambiguity you cite. And it seems to me that part of what happened is that this administration said, we aren't going to go it alone. We do want to join with our allies in fighting this war on terrorism. You know, Bush had talked about being humble as a nation. A lot of things seem to bode well for America's standing in the world. I would argue since then the picture has become much more complex. I don't think there were any people in Johannesburg a couple of weeks ago saying we are all Americans to Colin Powell.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. To Raleigh, North Carolina, Francis is on the line. Hi, Francis.
Yes, sir. Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you, sir. Mr. O'Rourke said a great deal of what I had to say. I will be brief. My perspective on this is rooted in a series of conversations I had years ago when I was in the Middle East with my Arab friends and mentors during the Iranian hostage crisis. And I keep going back to their level of absolute dumbfounded astonishment as to why then President Carter didn't unleash the dogs of war and bring hell down on Iran. To them, it showed Americans to be cowards, and therefore they had no respect and felt they could attack it with impunity. And just in reply to what the, I didn't get the lady's name, but
Geneva Overhaus.
Yes, Miss Overhaus. I want our borders shut. I want our U.S. troops back here to guard us. I want us out of the United Nations, NAFTA, NATO, and just as though it would be in any other country in the world, you simply don't walk in and sit down in Switzerland because you like cuckoo clocks and want to ski and suddenly become a Swiss citizen.
P.J. O'Rourke, Fortress America.
No, none for me, thank you. No, I want us to be as open as we possibly can. I have a wonderful story of anti-Americanism that I have told before, and I apologize to anybody who's heard me tell this before, but I was covering the Civil War in Beirut, and I got stopped at a roadblock on the south side of Beirut, which was then in control of the Shiite militias, and I was held at gunpoint when my American passport was discovered. I was held at gunpoint by the 16-year-old kid, and I was most worried that his gun safety knowledge seemed to be zip. I mean, I was much more worried about an accident than him actually shooting me, but he was screaming at me, and he screamed at me for 15 or 20 minutes about America the Great Satan, America the father of Zionism, America causing all this oppression and horror in the world. And when he got done, he then said, and as soon as my green card comes through, I am going to Detroit to study in dental school.
Mr. O'Rourke, may I? Do you really want this chap over here on a student visa?
You know, my guess is that this has been a long time ago. My guess is that he's right here and that he's a prosperous dentist outside Detroit and probably friends with some friends of mine and playing golf on the Inverness Country Club down in Toledo this very afternoon.
Well, sir, I almost had the same circumstance happen to me in Libya with a green recruit that I thought was gonna blow us all out of our van. And I hope you're right, but I think there's a very likely process, sir, that this guy could be down in his basement with a soldering iron and a bag of Radio Shack parts thinking, now I'm going to get that son of a bitch I missed at the checkpoint.
Well, I hope not. But, you know, I don't really understand. I don't really know what we would do to prevent that. I mean, America has to remain an open society because otherwise it's just not America. It's Switzerland, and I don't want to be surrounded by cuckoo clocks.
Well, I don't either. But by the same token, we do have a mechanism for bringing people into this country and allowing them to become Americans and to be absorbed. We have a terrible problem with illegal aliens now here in Mexicans here in Raleigh, North Carolina. We've had the first houses of prostitution that I can remember since before I went into the Navy popping up here in Raleigh. We've got a methamphetamine problem and all the rest of it that comes with a subculture that exists outside the law.
I'm not going to necessarily buy into the idea that that came only straight from south of the border, Francis, but I want to move on. Thank you for your call. 1-800-423-8255 to Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Nasheen is with us. Hi, Nasheen.
Hi, Dick. Quick comments here. 9/11 and how it affected my life. I'm an Indian Muslim, and I'm an immigrant here. The first thing I noticed upon 9/11 was, you know, bridging the gap between the color and background I represent and American people here. A lot of people tend to think that, you know, in the general term, Americans are a general population. Well, you know, I did run into people saying, well, oh, are you Hindi? Are you Hindu? Are you Islamic? You know, not knowing the difference, really. But
was it useful to you that they were asking the question, or did that seem kind of creepy?
No, actually, I actually found it amusing, but then I would reach out to them and, you know, tell them the difference between Hinduism and Islam. And
why don't you ask them if they're Methodist or Lutheran or something?
Right. Well, the point being that, I mean, this was a time for me and them to reach out and make this special connection. And what I did really learn, you know, when I've had this discussion with several people after 9/11, at the grocery store, at the hairdressers, even at work, and the one common truth that I could extrapolate out of this is the hands that help are holier than the lips that pray, regardless of what ethnic background or religious, you know, sect you belong to. And the second thing I want to make a comment about is, had 9/11 occurred in any other country in the world, no other population would have reached out to try and learn so much about such a, you know, distant religion or something that's so alien and otherwise as the Americans did. They reached out. People from the church came over to the mosque. People were genuinely trying to understand what Islam is all about. And had this happened in any other
country?
Well,
wait a second here, Nasheen. You can turn that around and say the reaching out came because the level of ignorance was higher here than it might have been in any other country where the different religions lived together, no?
Right. Well, I beg to differ because the Americans, I believe, and this is my personal opinion, are a very compassionate population, and they're very understanding. You know, where else do you see people stop and let others go in a traffic jam? You certainly wouldn't find that in India. And You know, I think it's because of their level of compassion that they wanted to reach out, not necessarily because of their ignorance. A lot of people out in India are ignorant about, you know, the different kinds of, you know, religions that are practiced in other parts of the world. So I don't think that necessarily makes them any more culturally literate. I think it's that the fact that they were more inclined to learn because they're compassionate. They want to know what the other religion's all about. So these two things made a huge impact in my life. And to the degree that someone was so curious about what Islam's all about and borrowed a copy of the Quran from me, and, you know, these are things that have touched my life, and I think it's given me an opportunity to bridge the gap in the ethnic background that I come to represent in this country.
Geneva, excuse me for just a second, Nasheen, but I'm interested in hearing Geneva's sense of the unbelievable contrast I hear between your sense of what's changed and Francis's sense of perhaps what ought to change. I mean, talk about a representative either end of the pole here, Geneva.
Well, actually, I don't think I disagree with what she's saying at all. I think the eagerness to figure out about Islam, especially because it had so directly affected us in this, in what people were extrapolating at least, was very real. But I'd be interested in the caller's view of what has happened at the University of North Carolina with this debate over whether or not people there ought to read about the Quran.
Nasheen, are you familiar with this court case that's currently underway, people raising questions about whether or not the Quran should be required reading in an introductory course on religion?
Yes, I did hear about that. And I think, well, if it's a part of a course and if there are students there who oppose it, it should not be taught there, because this is something that people pick up and read only if they're interested. I despise any sort of organized religion. I myself, as a practicing Muslim, do not go to the mosque. I believe religion is a very personal concept to me, and this has come about by the concept that's been instilled in me from day one by my parents, which is hands that help are holier than than the lips that pray. But to me, too, I mean, I take from the broader guideline of Islam a mini framework to work for me, and it's my religion that I follow. I don't follow it to the T. I don't wear the hijab, and I don't cover my hair. But So coming back to your point, Dick, I don't think it should be mandatory, and if people do not wish to be part of it, I certainly don't think people should be forced to read it. Now, if it is a course to enlighten sort of, you know, world studies or religion about religions around the world, and if this was a chapter from that, yes, I don't have a problem with it. But I'm, you know, pro-choice, and you just go to do what you want, and you do not enforce the Quran or any holy book as a course.
Let's not get too stuck on that. Fuad, I'd like to hear your sense of the contrast of views that we've heard between Nasheen and Francis here.
Well, I think that basically if we go back to the issue of, without getting too bogged down in the details of the North Carolina case, I think the people who raised the question, they raised the question about the text they were assigned. They were not assigned the Quran. They were assigned a commentary on the Quran, which was somewhat selective and sanitized. And that was the argument that people felt. But to sharpen it somewhat, to sharpen the discussion, I think there is a fundamental problem here. And that's really what I just want to move in that direction, that though we spoke after September 11 and we tried to in some way understand that anti-Americanism, that generalized hatred, particularly in the lands of Islam, the kind of scapegoating of America, the demonization of America that was going on, and though our president spoke about the axis of evil states, that is, you know, we know they are Iran, Iraq, and so we threw in North Korea there for reasons that I can never figure out. But fundamentally, the attack didn't originate from the politics of Iran and Iraq and North Korea. Our dilemma was that these hijackers, for the most part, came from lands which are extremely friendly in terms of their government to the United States. That is, in particular, we have a problem because in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, we have befriended the rulers, but it's there where the animus against America seems to run deep. And so we are confused. It's very difficult to get at this generalized hatred. And I want to quote a very, very gifted man, an Egyptian playwright, Ali Salem, who tried, if you will, to comment on this anti-Americanism that's so rampant in his own country, Egypt, which receives more than $2 billion a year but bears a tremendous amount of ill will. And he said, look, people who try to understand this anti-Americanism with reason, it's like trying to understand or trying to measure distance in kilograms, to measure distance in kilograms. It's not quite amenable to reason. I mean, I am befuddled a lot of time by the anti-Americanism in the Arab world. And stealing from the book of our gifted friend PJ, I just have one small 30-second soundbite and anecdote about this strangeness of this anti-Americanism. Recently, a former student of mine from the Gulf, from Saudi Arabia, came to visit me. And he had all spent about an hour and a half trashing America as passionately, as indiscriminately as he could. And then he said, after about an hour and a half of this, he said, "I'll be seeing you before long." And when I inquired what brings him before long again to American shores, he said, well, his wife is pregnant and he would like to bring her so she can deliver her child in the United States because he wants the child to be an American citizen. That's our fate. And there is something about this duality of America. There is the Americanization of large chunks of the world and the anti-Americanism.
PJ, to be hated and imitated at the same time.
Well, anybody who's a parent knows what that's all about, you know.
Yes.
I mean, it's a great compliment, you know. I mean, every teenage kid goes through this, and in a sense, the world is in adolescence in its attitude towards America. That's one thing, you know, that's clear to me. And the other thing, of course, is the difference between America as a large, powerful nation. People are always looking for the explanation behind the frustrations of their life, large and small. And if you go into interior of Africa or you go into certain areas of Asia, you will find that they're still blaming the British. India, if you go out back in India, you will find you'll have these discussions about how the British, the Queen, controls all the gold in the world. And that's why we are poor, because the Queen has all the gold. And so you blame the biggest thing that's around, and that's us by a long shot. That doesn't mean that you don't want the freedoms we have.
I have to just interrupt you there, PJ, because we're stepping away for a short break. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Your thoughts on whether or not things will ever be the same. What has changed? Have things changed? I'd like to hear from you. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. With me on the program today, the Director of Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins University, Fuad Ajami, and he's also a columnist at U.S. News and World Report. Geneva Overholser is with us. She's a professor of public affairs reporting at the Washington Bureau of the Missouri School of Journalism, and P.J. O'Rourke, correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly, is also with us. His latest book is CEO of the Sofa. And we're going to Newport News, Virginia. Jeffrey's on the line. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'm refreshing to hear someone, P.J. Rourke's comments, because I totally agree with his opening statement. The world hasn't changed. Americans, I believe, just weren't paying attention, had turned his back on the rest of the world, the events that were going on, the atrocities that were going on in the different parts of the world. And I think that plays a part in one of the reasons why there is such this anti-American attitude in the rest of the world. It's because of our so-called sophisticated or uppity attitude that we have, or condescending attitude we have toward the rest of the world.
What about the idea, Jeffrey, that the American military is engaged abroad in a way that it hasn't been in years, that the talk of a preemptive war that's coming out of Washington and sort of driving the agenda is also something new, that aren't those kind of big ways that the country expresses itself abroad different, and in large part as a reflection of what happened on September 11th?
Yeah, but it, to me, it's just a knee-jerk reaction that we have to something we don't know. We don't know what's going on, so let's go out and attack it and kill it. we haven't delivered it. And like I said, and that's one of the reasons I believe that the world has this attitude about us. We weren't engaged in any conflicts in these parts of the world when these things could have been dealt with diplomatically. Then all of a sudden we come in with a heavy-handed fist without actually getting the total gist of what's at the root of the conflicts and why. We don't discuss that much in the United States.
Let me go back to PJ with that one on just, you know, I add to that the civil liberties debate that's gone on and as people try to make sense of what Ashcroft's all about as well.
Well, to take the first thing first, there are a lot of bad people in the world, and it would be nice to ignore them, but it turns out they don't go away. It would be nice to buy them off, but it turns out they don't want to be bought. I'm afraid we're going to have to do something about this. I mean, this has been our experience many times in the past, and I'm afraid it's our experience again now. So America is able and willing to do something, apparently, about the bad people in the world. And I'm afraid we're going to go have to go ahead and do that.
Is the able and willing a mark of something that's changed, though?
Well, no. I mean, not really, because I mean we have done it over and over again since 1917. So I don't think it's really changed. I mean, what has happened is we go through cycles of trying to ignore the badness overseas, and then we realize we can't, and then we go through cycles of trying to change it. And this is one more cycle. One of the reasons I'm not willing to say that we have changed enormously since a year ago is that I'm still waiting to see what we're going to do. I saw what we did in Afghanistan. I think that was very good. I think that was right and proper. But we have to keep going. And it's a little too soon to tell whether we will and how we will, whether we'll do it and whether we'll do it right. This all remains to be seen. And it's only in the wake of that that I'll be able to say whether we changed or not.
Geneva Fouad, this the military expression of the United States abroad, help inform this conversation?
Well, yeah. I'm intrigued that we are focusing so much on what the rest of the world thinks of us, as opposed to what is our role now as the sole superpower. I mean, that question confronted us before 9/11, but certainly the way we're answering it after 9/11 has changed somewhat, hasn't it? The military response is an important part of it. It seems to me most Americans overwhelmingly supported our effort to strike out against terrorism. Now it's more complex what we're going to do, but it's interesting to me that PJ and the preceding comments have focused on this question of what, you know, the bad people out there in the world. Certainly we have to worry about that as the only superpower around, but don't we have to worry about a lot more? I mean, the more fundamental question than what the rest of the world thinks of us is how are we now going to behave? What kind of leader are we going to be internationally? We have not only bad people, but a lot of bad problems, a lot of economic challenges, a lot of environmental challenges. And you know, Dick, you were trying to get us to focus on the interesting contrast between what those two callers, Francis and Nasheen, I believe they were saying. It seems to me they were defining, in some ways, the two ends of what kind of face we present to the world, what kind of leadership. Do we essentially pull back into our borders, except where we need to go militarily against somebody? Or do we understand ourselves as a certainly vulnerable, open, free nation, part of a broader world with this intricate, complex globalization going on and with ourselves as leaders? And I think that's very much an open question, what kind of leader we're aiming to be now. It seems to me the Bush administration is very interesting in this response because on the one hand they seem to be really kind of headed toward the go-it-alone route, but now they're clearly attempting to persuade allies and to have the debate in the public. The president said we need to do that and to take the question before the United Nations. It'll be real interesting to see.
And interesting, Fouad, that Geneva's put her finger on this, whether or not America defines itself by how she's seen abroad or how she chooses to act and let the others see what they want.
Well, in a way, there are some the tragic part of all this, the part that's difficult sometimes to fathom, is that the ways that others think of us have nothing to do with our conduct. I mean, consider this. I track the Muslim world and the Arab world quite closely. It's what I do for a living. And what intrigued me is the fact that American power was used three times in the 1990s in Kuwait, in Bosnia, in Kosovo, on behalf of Muslims. And you will never find an Islamist, an Islamic fundamentalist, or an Arab secularist express any gratitude for America. I mean, no one really will come out and say that, look, American power and the American Air Force broke Serbian nationalism and rescued the Bosnians and rescued Sarajevo and rescued the Kosovars in 4 years later. It's our fate. There is something about the destiny of a great power to be viewed this way, to be depended upon and resented at the same time. And as far as the behavior and the policies of the Bush administration in the year behind us, they've been quite on the mark in many ways. They prosecuted a very good war. They've now faced a twilight war. It's not quite war, it's not quite peace. Al-Qaeda is represented in something like 50 to 60 countries. And you have to find them, you have to fight them in the shadows, you have to try to smoke them out. And you have to do it while the rest of the world is gazing upon you, while people don't turn over to you evidence, or they don't turn over to you suspects because you have the death penalty. There are all kinds of Islamist radical leaders who are now in Germany, in England, and so on, and we cannot extradite them either to their countries of origin, which want them for all kinds of crimes, Egyptians and others, or we can't bring them here to justice in the United States because the Europeans will not cooperate. So there is something about the solitude, if you will, of a great power like ours. And I think the Bush administration has understood this and has worked with the people who want to work with it. And it actually, we have many more allies in the shadows, in secret, behind closed doors, than we are led to believe if we listen to the pronouncements. I always say, in the third world, don't listen to what the foreign minister says. Listen to what the interior minister, that's the usually there. It doesn't have anything to do with the bald eagles or the forest. It's the ministers of police in the third world. So we have some cooperation in many countries, and we are pursuing these terrorists in Indonesia, in the Philippines, in Thailand, and we are trying to smoke them out as best we know how. And then finally, we are trying to close the circle, if you will, and head to Iraq, because there is a connection between the kind of terrorism we saw after September 11, 2001, and this regime in Baghdad, which has been a source of radicalism and anti-Americanism for a good decade.
Let's go to Laurinburg, North Carolina. Lisa's on the line. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there. My comment is just that, actually, regarding what the four of you agreed upon earlier, the Nous sommes tous Américains headline in the Le Monde, and for me, it's been sort of the opposite, in that I feel that I am now more in touch with the plight of citizens throughout the world, because everybody, it seems, has had to live with some kind of terrorism or violence against them from even agents of their own government. And as an American, I was very sort of cavalier about that. I never had to experience it, and so I never appreciated the anxiety that the world lives in until now. And so when Geneva's asked the question about what kind of a superpower are we, I'm hoping that we are at least now a little more sensitive because we know what it's like to be afraid.
Are you one of those people who would have answered the New York Times poll about how are you feeling, that you would say, though, while you feel a little bit more connected to what's going on in the rest of the world, you're also feeling a little less safe, a little more uneasy about being a part of that?
Yes, on both counts. When I visited England and I learned that there weren't trash cans on the sidewalk because there could be a bomb, you know, a bomb might be placed in one. That was my first, it was years ago, but it was my first initiation to the world. And now I feel that what happened on September 11th is the whole country's initiation to the way of the world, and that maybe we'll be a little more sensitive to the pain that other people live with.
PJ, are we back to where you began with that idea that it's not actually the world that's changed, but our own perception of America's place in the world?
You know, I think we have a kind of a short memory about this. There was a lot of sort of low-level terrorist attempts during the 60s. I was at LaGuardia Airport, Christmas 1975, and a huge bomb blew up there. I think it killed about 9 people or something like that. It was in the locker downstairs. There was a raft of bombing in the 70s in New York City, Puerto Rican Independence Group. the ringleader of which eventually blew off both his hands when he put one together wrong. It didn't hurt my feelings, I may say. I spent 20 years wandering around the world, and where these things are unfortunately more common than they are in the United States. But I think if we had a sense of security, especially given the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center, if we had a sense of security before last September, it was out of pure forgetfulness or inattention that we had that sense of security.
Geneva, you live in Washington. Do you look at the planes in the sky and consider your home a different place?
Sure, which is part of what I meant at the beginning about right. Our fears have changed and our memories have changed. I mean, I'm sort of glad my youngest kid is headed off to Hanover, New Hampshire, which should be very safe, right? Except then you think about murders and no place is safe. I thought that was a particularly thoughtful comment from Lauren Bird, where I might say I graduated from high school. But I think the one other point that I'd like to add is that I'm a bit struck, and maybe this is in this category of what hasn't changed, that, you know, we're sitting around talking a whole lot about the rest of the world and whether they don't appreciate what we do, and no matter what we do, they'll think ill of us, and they'll, you know, say all sorts of bad things about us, and then all wish they could come here. That's really, I mean, I think if I were listening to this in Germany or France or somewhere, I'd think, oh, my God, these Americans are still so provincial. And it seems to me that we need to think beyond that about what we could be doing and ought to be doing to make a safer world more thoughtfully than this emphasis on whether or not the rest of the world appreciates us is indicating that we're doing.
Fuad, our time's a little bit short. Time for a last word from you.
Well, I think that basically to close the circle, I return to this idea of the vulnerability of America to these furies of distant lands. And I think that we now understand, and I agree with the one caller, the last caller, who basically, in many ways, these furies that are the daily life of other lands now have visited American shores.
Fuad, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Fuad Ajami, Director of Middle East Studies, Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, columnist with U.S. News and World Report. Geneva Overholser, thanks again.
Thank you.
Geneva's Professor of Public Affairs Reporting at the Washington Bureau of the Missouri School of Journalism. P.J. O'Rourke, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
P.J. is a correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly, author of the book CEO of the Sofa. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Clint Cavanaugh and Meredith Levinson. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is